You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, all you wiretappers out there. Just want to warn you that tonight's show was a Facebook Live production we did a few months ago that I happened to stumble across, and I thought I would put this up as a bonus episode. So the sound will be a little bit different, but the content will be just as good as ever. Good evening, all you wiretappers out there. We're here in the Big Dumb Fun Show, Studio 4, with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, we're doing a Facebook Live. I hope you can hear us out there. I see Rick's out there and David. I see David Breakspear's out there. Another one of David's friends just showed up, Carlos. Hey, guys, it's good to have you on board here. We're going to start talking about a little investigation I was involved in back in the day. Now, I want to warn you, it's not going to be the mob. All right, well, let's start talking a little crime. What do you think, Aaron? You want to start talking a little crime?
Well, you said you have a story.
I've got a story.
A story of from your own career.
From my own career. I've had, I think it was Ben Ellickson said, you need to tell more stories from your own career. Now, I have to warn you, this is not a mafia story, but I think it's a pretty good story.
Well, some people, if they want to hear stories from your career, also would have to go all the way back to some of the very beginning episodes of Gangland Wire. There's like 4, 5, 6, 7, all the when they tried to bomb Tuffy DeLuna, which was some of your story that you had, your own personal experience.
Yeah.
And I think another great one was about when the Klan was trying to get their own cable access show.
Yeah,
that's another great personal story that Gary shared.
That wasn't mafia either.
No, but.
But it was a good story.
It was a true story.
It was true. Well, this is a true story. So I'm a young detective. We had just formed a what we called a station detective unit. They had taken the residential burglaries and larcenies away from the downtown burglary unit, and they just handled commercial burglaries. So we were supposed to handle all the residential burglaries. And we had a rash of burglaries in a high-rise downtown, the River Hills apartment complex, which actually, there is a mob connection there. The Italian restaurant on the lowest level of River Hills apartment complex was called Gaetano's, and it was owned by Gaetano Lococo, who was one of the what they called the Five Iron Men, or the original Sugar Shack Gang, out of the 1930s, and it was involved with Prohibition, Prohibition was involved with bootlegging, was one of the mob guys that helped with the bootlegging. He actually was caught in the middle of a hit. He and Charlie Gargatta were trying to kill a bar owner, Anton Ferris, I think was his name. They were trying to kill him, and the sheriff at the time, 1934, I believe, Tom Bash, was going home with his daughter and his wife in the car. And he pulled around the corner out there at Armour and Forest, and there these guys are just shooting at Anton Ferris in his car. They'd caught him, got him stopped there. He had a club right down the street. So they were shooting him up. He jumps out of his car with a gun and engages in a gun battle with Charlie Gargatta, and Gargatta goes down. He doesn't hit him, but somehow he slipped and fell, and they got him under control. Some other policemen came along, I believe, and then they chased after this other guy, and it turned out it was Gaetano Lococo, or Tano Lococo, who they caught later on. But yeah, and you know what? The sheriff interrupted this mob hit, and they killed this guy. And the only conviction that came out of it was for Charlie Gargatta, and he had the murder weapon in his hand, and they convicted him of possession of an illegal weapon because it was stolen from the National Guard Armory over in Kansas City, Kansas. So that's
which is another story.
Which is another story. I'm sure I don't really know anything more
about that. A little bit.
We probably did. We probably talked about the night Tom Bash. But anyhow, Gaetano Lococo owned that restaurant in the basement, but he didn't really have anything to do with this story. I digress. You know how I digress every once in a while, Aaron.
Well, there was a mob connection to this building where there was
to the building, yeah. And there's another mob connection to one of our victims. God, they were everywhere back then. We started getting reports of burglary after burglary with no forcible entry in this one apartment complex. And we can't figure it out. We go down and we talk to people. Nobody seems to know, you know, what the deal is. It's like somebody's got a key and they know when people are home and when they aren't home. This has been going on 2 or 3 weeks. There must have been 10 burglaries in a really short period of time. And they always lost, you know, just the small items if they had any jewelry. And this one lady lost some really expensive pieces of jewelry. She was a manicurist in a downtown barbershop at the Muehlbach Hotel. And she lost, you know, I want to say like $20,000, $25,000 worth of jewelry. And she even had pictures of the pieces. And she said, this is what they look like. And this is the same piece that I lost. And she was, she had a huge loss. Some of the others, one guy lost his old 8mm pornographic tapes and his 8mm projector and just a variety of different things people had in their houses and anything that was small.
Had he taken photos of those as well? Like she had taken her jewelry and taken photos of it?
No. She had these were out of a jewelry catalog or something. She just tore them out.
She's like, this is where I ordered it.
Yeah. No. Well, I asked her where she got it, and she said, because it was really unusual that somebody who was a manicurist would have that kind of jewelry. And she said, well, just different friends gave them to me over the years. She was really attractive, but she was probably, I was probably 28 or 29, and she seemed like older woman to me. She was probably 50. At the time, but you could tell she had been one hot item when she was younger. I can see where a man might want to give her an expensive piece of jewelry. So about a week or so later after the last report, it seemed like they were slowing down. There hadn't been one for quite a while. We're down at police headquarters. We work out of the station. We're down at police headquarters. And I looked down at the holdover sheet, and there's a guy somebody's been arrested the night before for a theft, some kind of a felony theft, a larceny, and it was a place where he worked. And I said, well, John, let's talk. I had a partner, John Fraze, and I said, John, let's talk to this guy, see what's going on with him. Usually, technically, it would be an embezzlement, and that would go to another unit, but I thought, well, it'd be an easy clearance. We'll get him to confess real quick because they kind of caught him. They had plenty of evidence. Basically, they caught him in the act. And he came in down from the jail, and he had a security guard uniform on. Well, that's interesting. And we started talking to him, and we asked him. He was working. I can't remember where he was working, where he stole. He stole something where he was working. And we said, well, where else have you worked before? Because we're thinking, you know, this guy, this isn't his first rodeo. He's been around before. He said, I worked at the River Hills apartment complex. We said, uh-oh. John and I went out in the hall, and I said, John, I'll never forget this. I said, there's meat on this bone. He teased me about this for the next several years, about me saying that there's
meat on that bone.
So we go back in, so we start talking to him. We're trying to break him down, and we tell him we're going to take him across the street and book him into the county jail, and he's going to be charged with felony theft. And it would have been an easy one to break down to a city theft and put him in city court, but we decided to go hardcore on him. And then he started getting scared. And he said, I don't want to wear the security guard uniform over there. And they take me up to the jail. And we said, well, you know, what do you got for us? We'll work something out. And he said, well, and you could tell he had something that was eating at him that he could use. And I said, you used to work at the River Hills apartment complex, didn't you? Yeah, I did. I told you that. I said, you know, there's a whole bunch of thefts there. Do you know anything about that? You tell us about that, and we can handle all this. We'll handle your case. We're going to book you in over to the county jail and charge you. But if this all works out, we'll drop the charges. And we'll go home, run over to your house and get some plain clothes where you don't have to wear that security guard uniform over there. And he broke down. And he said, well, there's this guy. This guy named Daryl, and he couldn't really pronounce his last name. He butchered it up. We figured out it was Gilliard. He said, Daryl Gilliard, he gave me some money, and then he's given me a little bit of money all along, and I gave him a master key to all the apartments, and I gave him a list of names of tenants and telephone numbers. So we said, aha, we got Daryl Gilliard. We go check out Daryl Gilliard. We take him across the street, and he ends up posting a bond pretty quick, but he still got this charge hanging over him. We need him to help us. And we get him to call Daryl Gilliard up and, you know, talk to him about it. And Daryl says, hey, I'm going to be going back in pretty soon. And so he kind of pushes Daryl a little bit. And, And we find out Daryl's planning on going back in the next week, possibly the next Monday or Tuesday. We didn't know for sure. Daryl, he tells Daryl that, that he, you know, to hit a certain apartment. He thinks there's something good in there. And so they're working this little deal out. And we've got Daryl's picture. Daryl's on parole from a 10-year robbery conviction. So we got a good solid criminal here. We get his picture. We get the tax squad, which is, we were in the burglary squad. There was only a residence burglary squad. We called it the field investigators. And we get only a... damn it, I just lost my train of thought. We get the tax squad, which is 10 or 12 uniformed guys that can... They're the SWAT team is what they are that's assigned to the station. And we can get them to put on, go into plain clothes and get some plain cars, and we set up a surveillance at the River Hills. Because it's got four different entrances into it. It's a big apartment complex, four different entrances, and it's got a 4 or 5 story underground parking lot. And there's a elevator off the parking lot, of course. And so we have to have somebody on every floor of the parking lot. We have to have somebody at all the entrances, and then in the lobby. In case he just comes in the front door and everybody's to look out for this Daryl Gilliard and they know what he looks like. So I never forget. I was down in one of the lower levels sitting in the car of the parking lot. My partner and one of the tech guys were in the front lobby. Had a couple of tech guys in each of the side doors and other tech guys on each of the levels of the parking lot. And I'm sitting there, and I see 3 or 4 young, and this guy's a black guy, and Daryl Gilliard is. I see 3 or 4 young white guys, and they're walking around the parking lot looking in cars. So I radio up, and I said, you know, I think there's some guys that are looking to break in cars down here. And sure enough, they were. About that time, you know, crash. And they broke out the side window of a car, and I radioed again, and some of the guys... they were out around the perimeter of a 2-man car that was just kind of cruising. The perimeter came flying in. They snatched up these 2 guys, took them out and whisked them off in case Daryl came in about the time that they were arresting them, threw them in their car, drove them out of the parking lot and down the street and just held them in a, called a wagon, just held them in the car.
They didn't see you sitting in your car?
No, they never did see me. So we get that handle. We're waiting. And finally somebody up in the lobby radios and they said, he just went in. So they watched, they were sitting in the lobby chair. He just walks in, bold as day, walks in, goes in the elevator, goes up the elevator. He's there for a while. And so we just wait. And thank God, we didn't know for sure what apartment he's going to. Thank God he didn't go into an apartment where somebody was in there and he ended up hurting somebody because we let him go. And we knew what he was going to do, but we had to get him on. You had to get him. You couldn't follow him up the elevator. There's no way you could follow him. This apartment building is vacant during the day.
He'd be suspicious.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you got a 25 to 30-year-old white guy following you up, going wherever you're going. It's athletic and fit and all that.
And it's a building full of older people.
And it's a building full of older people, exactly. You got it, Aaron. So we just let him go up. Pretty soon he comes back down. They grab him. When he comes back down, they find a bunch of stuff on him. We figure out which apartment he went into. We had to wait till that evening when the person got home because he didn't take anything with a name on it. Got him down to headquarters, booked in. I had to go to an off-duty job, and John stays there and brings him back down in the evening and starts interrogating him. He starts breaking down, and we start trying to make a deal with him. And we said, you know, if you'll tell us where you got this jewelry, where we can find this jewelry and get it back and some of this other stuff. And he said, well, a lot of the stuff is over at this girl's apartment that I sometimes mess around with. And the jewelry was down at Kriegel's Jewelry Store, which is a downtown jewelry store, you know, top of the line, you know, nice jewelry store. And he said, that guy bought a bunch of the jewelry from me. So the next day we get search warrants for the girl's apartment. We go over there and we find the pornographic, the old dirty movies and the projector, and a whole bunch of other stuff. We find the list of apartment tenants and their phone numbers, and we find the master key. as well as some other items that were listed as stolen. A lot of the stuff was already gone. And we find a gun. There was one gun that was listed as taken, and the victim on it was a judge, Judge Harry Davis. He was an associate circuit court judge. So we were pretty happy to find that judge's gun. We'd want to make points with him. Bring all that stuff down. We go down to Kriegel's. Mr. Kriegel does not want to cooperate with us.
He spent money to buy that jewelry.
He did. He was like, oh, no. And I'll have to talk to my lawyer about this. So we leave. We go back over to the prosecutor's office, and we tell the prosecutor, here's what we got. And he won't cooperate, so the prosecutor gives us a search warrant. We'll go back over about an hour later, and Kriegel's still there. And we talked to him again. I said, you know, we want to see this jewelry if you've got it and inspect some of your jewelry. And he said, I've got it. But he said, I got to talk to my lawyer first. So we just flopped the search warrant out on him. We said, okay, well, we're just going to go through all your stuff until we find it because we have a search warrant right there. And oh, God, he was mad. He went down to the safe and he got out several pieces that were the pieces he bought from Daryl Gilliard.
Why didn't he call his attorney while you guys were gone for an hour?
Well,
He probably did,
but they were just trying to fob us off is what they were trying to, I don't know what he was trying to do. The prosecutor was funny, was the prosecutor was madder than hell the next day because his boss had gotten, because this guy was pretty well politically connected, and he'd gotten hold of somebody who got hold of the main prosecutor, who then went down to our prosecutor as an associate and said, hey, what are you doing issuing search warrants on Kriegel's jewelry down there? we said, I don't know. I mean, we told you the deal. He wouldn't let us in. He had the stuff. I mean, we got it here. We got it back. So we think we've got this wrapped up. And Dale Gilliard, so we agree to not oppose a lighter sentence until the prosecutor and the prosecutor can tell the judge about his cooperation because we got a lot of the stuff back. But
you have like 10, 12 robberies?
Yeah, burglaries.
Burglaries.
But then we have a couple of more all of a sudden. And so we go get Daryl and we say, what's going on, dude? He said, well, man, he said, I didn't tell you everything. And that's when he told us the rest of it. He said, well, there's this guy, young white guy named Larry. And he said, I sold him a copy of that list and that key. And so we figure out who he is. We go back down, and we have to do this two or three days in a row. We didn't put such a big full-court press on it. We sit in the lobby, and finally Larry shows up. He goes upstairs. When he comes back down, we snag him, bring him in, and get a search warrant for his house. We know where he's living after we bring him in. We get a search warrant for his house. And we find stolen property from all kinds of car burglaries, car break-ins, and other burglaries from all over the city, and make him on that case. So Daryl, he's like, he finked out on us. He didn't tell us the total truth. So we just let the case go. He goes to trial. In the first trial, Daryl gets on the stand, and they ask him about breaking into that manicurist department. He said, because they got a fingerprint of his on the inside on the jewelry box. And he said, well, I met her downtown, and she invited me back up for a drink, and that must have been how my fingerprint got in. So they went through a whole trial. They get one juror who refuses to vote for conviction because he said, well, that could have happened. He said that could have happened. So it's not beyond a shadow of a doubt. So mistrial. They try him again, and this time they get him found guilty, and he gets about 7 or 8 years. He gets on the stand, and on that second one, he knows he's going down because he starts crying, and he starts complaining about those cops and how they promised him if he'd help them that they wouldn't charge him with this, and how much he helped us and all that. It was a wild one. And so Daryl goes back in, and he's in for a while. He comes back out. To wind up Daryl Gilliard, this dude, he comes back out. He gets a job with a trash hauler, Deaf and Baugh Trash Haulers. He gets a job. They have a industrial accident with the truck. He cut off both of his legs about halfway between the knee and the foot. He's lost both legs. He's walking around on some kind of prosthesis now. He gets this multi-million dollar settlement. He's living in River Hills apartment. Not River Hills. He's living.
He's living in River Hills.
Yeah. Well, now he actually could afford a much better place. Now he is living at the Crown Center condos right down by the Crown Center, which are all real high-end condos. And he has some kind. He's selling drugs, and he gets in some conflict with some girl in this drug dealing thing, and he kills her. So he ends up going back to the penitentiary, and they convict him of murder in the end. Even after he got this multi-million dollar settlement, you can't write that kind of stuff, man.
And he's still in jail?
I assume. I think he's probably dead by now. His brother was a serial rapist.
Dude.
A few years after that, we're investigating him. We see his brothers were searching, searching the computer, and we find his name. We find his brother's name, Lorenzo Gilliard. So we see he's got one conviction for rape. This is 1975 or 1974. He's got one conviction for rape. And we get him in and talk to him, and he doesn't tell us anything. And we let him go, and about 20 years later, all of a sudden, his name's on the front page of the Kansas City Star as the Prospect Avenue rapist. He's raped about 10 or 12 girls. He was a serial rapist for like 2 or 3 years' time. So I guess that was a real crime family, huh?
I guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
I don't know what their dad was like. These were brothers, but I'd say they both had pretty much an abusive childhood, I got a feeling.
I mean, after he loses his legs, I mean, he goes back to jail. It doesn't matter. He's doing short time no matter where he's at.
Short time no matter where he's at. That's a good one, Aaron.
Seems funny now, but...
Wasn't funny to him.
Probably not funny to the guy who's his boyfriend.
Now, another interesting little connection is I finally figured out years later who gave, I can't remember her name, the manicurist who gave her the jewelry. Bobby Arnold, my partner Bobby Arnold, and I have decided, I may have told this, it seemed like I've told this story before somewhere.
Yeah, I didn't want to give it away. I think I'd heard this.
We're going after this guy named Morris Klein, known as, or called him Snag Klein. He was an old bookmaker, an odds maker. He was like the Mayor Lansky, the Jewish contingent to the Kansas City crime family.
And he loved a good manicure?
And he loved a good manicure. We're sitting down, and he has the Time to Read newsstand downtown. He always carried racing forms and that kind of thing. And he walks out. We'd never seen him before. We just said, let's go see what Snag Klein's doing. He walks out. He walks up the street to the Mule Buck. He goes in to the barbershop, and he talks to the manicurist quite a while. I don't think he even got a haircut. Maybe he got a haircut. But he talks to her pretty familiar. You could tell they were really familiar with each other. So I call her that night, and she gets all nervous. And I said, well, who was that you were talking to? She said, oh, you mean Mr. Klein? I said, yeah, Snag Klein. I said, okay, what do you know about him? Oh, he's just, a longtime customer. He's just a nice man. I said, okay, and hung up. And I went back into our files, and intelligence unit files, because I was in intelligence by now. And there it is. Her name is listed as the longtime girlfriend of Snag Klein. So then I realized all that jewelry came from Snag Klein, who bought it from other jewel thieves. There's no doubt in my mind. So it's that kind of wraps up all the loose ends of that story. The Great River Hills Caper. It was the first big caper I was involved in.
She got her jewelry back, though.
She got quite a little bit of it back. Not all of it, but quite a little bit of it back.
I mean, the guy that stole it probably didn't know it came from the Snag Klein.
No, he didn't know. He had no idea.
He robbed another apartment if he'd known that. He thought it was a big score.
Yeah. Of course, it's not like, everybody thinks the mafia is all-knowing and all-seeing. Well, they would have never figured out who this dude was.
Isn't it kind of ironic that you get the guy that's the security guard who gets busted for...
I know.
For doing a crime in a commercial building?
Yes.
And it turns out, he's the security guard that's letting all these other folks in.
And from the job he had before, it wasn't from the job he was at for whatever he was... I can't even remember where he was working when he was arrested when we started interviewing him. Yeah, it's talk about a small world and an ironic set of circumstances.
But he probably had done that before. So had you ever gone back? You never went back going, well, we cleared our case for
him. Right, we cleared. Yeah, we didn't go back.
I don't want to go back and search any other Like, you know, if you went back to his record of where he made
every place he worked, yeah, there had been stuff missing.
But there had been a bunch of robberies you could have solved.
Well, possibly, but lots of time employee theft like that, which would be really basically employee theft if he stole it. Employee theft like that many times is not reported. That you'd be lucky to find that, you know, another same circumstance that were, you know, he stole stuff. There's no, he stole anything. He probably was not nailed down. He thought he could get away with. It might not have been that he was in a position to
give somebody else the key.
Give somebody else the key and a list of the tenants and their phone numbers. So it was.
I thought one of the reasons with the list with the phone numbers was because then the thief would call the apartment.
Sure, he would call them, make sure there wasn't anybody home.
And see if anybody answered.
Oh, yeah, one more little wrap-up on that thing. Judge Harry Davis, he had this, it was a 32 caliber Smith & Wesson pistol, perfectly preserved. That's kind of an older gun. And so we just say, you know, we don't even send it out to the lab or anything. We want to be the big heroes, so we go snag it out of the property room before it's tested or anything. We really shouldn't have done that. Should have sent it out to the lab for testing. And then they'd gotten it back in about 6 months and he'd gotten his gun back. But we wanted to go give it back to Judge Davis right away. So we snagged the gun out of the property room and check it out and take it over and get him to sign that he got his gun back. And he starts telling the story how he got the gun. He said, well, he said, you remember Chief Kelly? We had, when I first came on in 71, I had a chief named Clarence Kelly. He was a former FBI agent and really well liked and respected. He'd, back in the late 60s, he was the chief. And Harry Davis was a judge, associate circuit court judge. And he said he went over, I think when the chief first got there or something, he said, I went over to meet the new chief and was talking to him. And I was talking about how I think I should have a gun. Now, I'm a judge. I think I should have some kind of a gun. What kind do you think I should get, chief? And he said, Clarence Kelly got on the phone and called Jim Newman, Colonel Newman, called one of his colonels in and said, Jimmy, he said, run down to the property room and get this man a nice little gun that he can use over there at the courthouse. So they just went down and got one that somebody confiscated out of the property room and gave it to the judge and went on, which is another kind of a breach of regulations. You just don't take guns out of the property room and hand them off to judges or anybody else.
I wouldn't think you would.
No, you wouldn't. But
didn't you have to check out the gun when you were returning it to the judge?
Oh yeah, we did. We did. We left a paper trail.
So that they knew that you had checked it out, that it went back to him.
That it had been returned to him.
He signed another piece of documentation saying
he
received it.
Oh yeah.
Well, what if you'd sent it off for testing? Sure, he waited 6 months, but what if it came back and it had been used in the crime?
Well, then they would keep it for another period of time, maybe forever. But, you know, you do what you do sometimes, and you don't always do everything perfectly. And sometimes you do things imperfectly, trying to score some points or further your career or whatever.
Well, I would think this manicurist, if she had a burglar and they kept broken her place and they stole that much jewelry, the first person I would call would be the police. It'd be Snag Klein.
Yeah, well, again, that's the misnomer of the mafia. The people thing, misnomer may not, it's not the right word. It's the misunderstanding of the power of organized crime in any city. People will think they're all powerful, all knowing. If any crime goes down, they're going to know who did it. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not true. If you got a security guard, an embezzling security guard who passes along some information to another professional thief who is black and has hardly ever been outside of south of 75th Street or east of Cleveland or Van Bryn or never north of downtown or west of the state line, and he exists in his little world. He doesn't interact with the mob. Mob guys don't interact with people like that. You're never going to figure out who they are.
He's not kicking up.
No, he's not kicking up to anybody. He doesn't even know anybody.
But the mob has their sources. You never know, but...
Now, promise me, they don't have sources like that. They do not have sources into the black community like that.
Well, you just got lucky.
We did.
You really just got lucky where you're able to, like, wait a second.
We did. But we did good police work. We had the luck that the security guard was there, but we also were smart enough to know that he may know something.
Yeah.
We're smart enough to know that when he said the River Hills, that we knew there'd been, he worked there, that there'd been a bunch of burglars there.
I don't know why he would have said that.
Well, he did. I mean,
like, I would just be like,
Well, you know, who knows?
He was afraid of going over to county wearing his security guard.
He was wanting our help. We knew that. He was wanting our help. He was petrified. And that's the thing you capitalize on as a policeman. When somebody's petrified, you go push them a little bit and push them a little bit and see what they know. You don't know what they know until they tell you. So you just act like you know something and you just keep pushing them and pushing them. And finally, they'll break if they got anything.
Well, what you know is you're the cops and they're in trouble.
That's right. That's right. That's part of the game. It's all in the game, yo. If you ever watch The Wire, it's all in the game.
Well, ironically, though, then he sells off this same list and key to some other guy who's also paying him money.
I know.
And just happens to forget to tell you about that. Like,
I know. I couldn't believe it. That River Hills caper was a gift that kept on giving. We were like king detectives around there, around the station, at least for a long time. Nobody had ever seen anything like that before. We actually get the TAC unit to go out and do a surveillance, and they actually catch somebody in the act. And then you get to catch another one in the act. You get to alert them again and catch them and get somebody else in the act. So it was a gift that just kept on giving, made our reputation as real good detectives.
Part of what got you into the intelligence unit?
Yeah, that was one of the things that would have helped to get me in the intelligence unit, that's for sure. You got to do good work to go to the top. Anyhow, all right, well, I think that's all I've got on this. You got any questions about that? Any more questions about that, Aaron?
Whatever happened to your partner?
Police procedure. Well, John Fraze went on to, he worked homicide. He worked in the intelligence unit for a while, and then he worked homicide. And then I left the intelligence unit in 92, and he came back and worked in the intelligence unit, maybe even up till he retired as a detective again. He never made it above detective. So he was in and out of homicide, intelligence, and burglary, maybe TAC. I can't remember for sure, but mainly homicide and intelligence.
Another question. How many, because you were now a detective.
Right.
How many years had you been working the street just as a plainclothes cop before you got moved up to be able to do detective?
You mean as a uniform cop? Yeah. It's about 2 years, I guess. I was on the streets. I had a district car about 2 years over in the east side. And then they formed this field investigators unit in the station. And they took one guy from each sector. So I got to be the guy from my sector because I already done a lot of stuff out there in the in the district car. Yeah, I'd done enough stuff by then. People had noticed that I was a go-getter because that's what you got to be.
I thought maybe because you were from Plattsburgh.
Plattsburgh, yeah.
They knew you were good at field work.
Field work, yo. Yeah, well, I was good at that, but I left that as soon as I could. No, I wasn't very good at that. Actually, I hated it. Mom used to say, I'd take you out to the farm, you'd beat me back to town.
And you're still doing that.
And I'm still doing that. Rich Howard probably knows about that. Go out and work in the field and beat them back to town. Anyhow, so I don't know.
So how does that then? You go from being just in a uniform as in a car driving in your patrol district.
Right.
You become part of this field unit.
Right. Field investigations unit, which were station detectives.
And then they say now you're a detective.
Right. And I was a detective. I worked that for about 2 years, and then there was an opening came in the intelligence unit. A good friend of mine, Bobby Arnold, was already down there, and he talked to the sergeant, Larry Wisher. And Larry Wisher had the opening, so I went down and interviewed with him and the other sergeant, and about 2 weeks later, they took me in the intelligence unit to be Bobby Arnold's partner mainly. And I did that for 13 years before I got promoted to sergeant, went back out in the field again. You got to go back out in the field and work nights when you get promoted.
I was going to say, weren't you, when you were doing the detective work, wasn't that mostly during the days?
Yeah, detective work, yeah, it's primarily during the days, depending on what you had to do.
Like you, what happened, there'd be a burglary, they'd be reported by the regular police.
In a 1974 Dodge Monaco. I think I had a Plymouth Fury. Ben, I think we had Plymouth Furies back then, but then the gas crisis hit, and we had God, we had one of the Ford Fairlanes, little six-cylinder Ford Fairlanes. Then we went to, I don't remember, oh, then we ended up in the Ford Crown Vicks later on for police cars. Now, an intelligence unit, everybody says, oh, I can spot an undercover car. You couldn't spot an intelligence unit car or a vice unit car. At one time, we actually, in the vice unit.
Because they just go down to the property room and get a car.
Now, I wish you could. We did do some things like that. We had a good, actually turned out to be a good friend of mine. Bob Smith has a used car lot at Gregory and Oak, and he used to supply the vice unit different cars all the time. They'd just go to the vice unit to, well, I mean, the vice guys would go over to Bob Smith's lot and get a car for the evening and drop it back off. Because one time one of them left his radio and his gun in the car underneath the seat. He found it. We started buying used rental cars, so everybody had a car, and they were always used rental cars, so you can't tell. You know, they're not all used Crown Vicks or used Plymouth Furies or whatever, although at one time they were. We had an intelligence unit. We had one car like that, and then we had two slick cars, like a 74 Nova and a 76 Pontiac something. I don't remember. And then we had one. Then we got an old station wagon from Radio Repair. It was some kind of a Chrysler Corporation thing. We used to, for a surveillance van, one of the guys had a connection with the, auto shop, auto repair shop up north of the river. And they would give us this big old van that used to be a bread truck. And we'd go out and do a surveillance in it.
Was it a box van?
Okay, yeah, box van. Because we didn't have a van. This was long before the day where you had a van. Man, that, later on, they had a, you know, they had this slick van with antennas hidden in pipes on the top, and a TV in it, and radios, and the whole been insulated, and the whole back end was fixed up like a jet plane cockpit. But back in those days, we just go get this old bread van, big old box van, and hang some papers, hang some draperies kind of over between the front seat and the back end, then get in the back end, get in the lawn chair, and then just each peek out between the curtains out through the front windshield. I spent many a day in that, like that.
Watching the local La Cosa Nostra.
La Cosa Nostra or whoever we needed to watch.
You didn't want to make it into an actual bread truck. Roma Bakery.
Let's see what
the
Ben
local
says.
Kansas City bakery that was Italian owned, Roma Bakery.
Hell yeah, that's a good one. When you drive a Crown Vic, and you're not a policeman, but everybody thinks you are, everybody slows down when you're going down the highway. Like, oh God, there's a policeman. slow down.
I thought that's sometimes why people buy a Crown Vic.
Well, they buy Crown Vics to maybe they think somebody's not going to stop them because they might be a policeman. Sorry about that little
bumper
siren. That was a siren. I think because we were talking about police cars, somebody turned the siren on. Well, here's another thing that the really good criminals, I've seen two of them in the city. Bobby Jean Jones, who's dead now. I wish I knew a little more about him. He would make a heck of a story. He comes in the periphery of another story. The night we caught the guy inside a bank burglary, but that's a story for another time. Bobby Jean Jones and, oh God, this guy's just getting out of the joint here pretty soon. He was a real professional criminal. Eddie Cox, actually Eddie Cox's daughter has contacted me, and I did some emailing with Eddie while he was in the joint. He's about ready to get out. I don't know. I couldn't seem to connect with him in a way that I wanted to. Maybe I'll try again if he gets out. We'll have him on the show. But those guys both bought Crown Vicks, put an antenna on them. And like Bobby Jones, he was going to do a burglary in a downtown jewelry store. He and another guy, and there was a homeless guy just hanging out on the street close to the alley where they were going to go down in the alley and break in through the back door. So he just told the homeless guy that he was a policeman and put him in the back seat of the what looked like a police car, drove him about 25 or 30 blocks east of downtown and dumped him off, and then went back down to dig the burglary. And this other guy, Eddie Cox, he had this Crown Vic car with an antenna on. He used to see him up and down Main Street a lot. Well, he was robbing drug dealers, and he actually ended up going back to the joint for robbing drug dealers. So there are some advantages of having a Crown Vic. See, Ben, you could have gone around and robbed drug dealers.
Yeah, it's a dangerous profession.
Yes, it is. We've had several shows on that, robbing drug dealers. All right, I think we've done it, don't you think?
You didn't make your public service announcement.
I didn't. Well, if you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call the first call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, ladies and gentlemen, you need to join us in a Facebook Live. And if you missed it, you need to go back and watch it, because you're going to learn about the Mob World Summit, which is June 15th, 16th, and 17th in Las Vegas. Join Gary Jenkins, myself, Frank Culotta, Ronald Finno, Larry Henry, and a cast of other notorious characters for 3 days of great mob history. Then, of course, you want to get Gary's documentary, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon to purchase, or you can rent it for a little bit less, but you want to watch it again and again, so you're going to want to buy that. And then there's more to know, because Gary has got an app, the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you could take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And then if that's not enough, you need to get Gary's book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination in Las Vegas casinos.
It's a great read, and it's a better Kindle, because the Kindle has hyperlinks to video files with the actual audio from the mouth of the men that did it, with a transcription, because sometimes it's a little hard to understand what they're saying.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.